and welcome to this edition of the Bad
the
Idea
tenth,
Podcast.
The 10th, man!
I'm not even bothering.
Numbers! These
I
are important!
I'm not even bothering to keep track anymore, because I don't have that sort of space in my brain these days. So, but Simon is telling me it's the 10th edition, so I will.
And thank you for introducing me!
The snide motherfucker to my left is Simon Abrams.
Oh, hi, and the stupid motherfucker to my right is Steve Carlson.
Hello, peoples!
And this is the Bad Idea Podcast. If you're joining us for the first time, the Bad Idea Podcast is a movie-themed podcast dedicated to just basically picking themes that are, if you were to just watch a bunch of these films based on that theme, it would be a really fucking bad idea.
And seeing if there's anything worthwhile salvaging there anyway.
Yeah, because, you know, you sometimes find when you're dumpster diving in a lot of crappy cinema, you actually find stuff that's well worth watching, and this time we actually, thankfully, did find something. But we just want to just tell you the theme this month. We're unfortunately a bit behind, and we had a fun idea for a Christmas-themed podcast, but we couldn't get it together because of the holidays. Our timing was off. But if you could just take yourself back
just
in a time
machine. Open your mind.
Open your
mind. Real wide.
I don't know why what accent that is, but yes.
It's non-specific.
Non-specific. And we just go back a few weeks to Christmas, and you're in the holiday spirit. What you know, you're watching Christmas Story, you're watching National Lampoon's, you're watching Once and Wonderful Life. But the most Christmassy thing that you could be watching is something that you probably didn't think of, and that's why we thought of it for you, and that's why this month's theme is a very Rennie Harlan Christmas.
You could be watching Die Hard 2.
You could be watching Die Hard 2. You could be watching
Deep Blue Sea.
Deep Blue Sea. You could be watching Cutthroat Island like we did today. You could be having a blast.
Yeah.
And a very Merry Christmas, and, you know, the hearth is roaring, and you're just like, you know what, man?
Rennie Harlan.
Ho, ho, ho. Ho.
Motherfucker.
Ho. I got a shark ate me in that one. Motherfucking shark ate me in that one.
Deepest,
anyway.
Bluest. Your hat is like a shark fin. But, wow. Anyway, we kind of wanted to explore beyond the known titles. Because, you know, Harlan's been working for God knows
how long.
My fly's
down. Hold on.
They don't know that on the podcast.
They do now. Hey, hey!
You could have kept that to yourself.
I don't know, man.
But, you know, because Harlan's been working for so long, and he's got something of a following, mainly based around, you know, Die Hard 2, Deep Blue Sea, you know, some of his more outre works.
Outre.
Is that how you say it?
It's outre, yeah, because there's a U. But the point is, people came up with a phrase, avant retard, to talk about Crank 2. That phrase was basically, yeah. Rennie Harlan was avant retard before the Crank guys made it look cool. And he wasn't even doing it on purpose either, which is what makes it really special.
I don't know Simon's exact
definition of avant retard.
No, Simon's motivation for throwing this out there, but I kind of wanted to get into some of his lesser celebrated works to maybe see if we could truly pin down what makes a Rennie Harlan film just that.
Well, I suggest
because I do happen to like the guy.
I do too.
Roughly anything he does.
I do too, but he's the kind
except
of like
except maybe 5 Days of War. I might skip that one.
He's like the kind of comfort food, like the cinema version of action cinema version of comfort food that like it's very like heavy, like Jewish cooking almost. And like you're gonna remember that more than like the texture or the taste of the food that you're eating. But like it's actually just the kind of stuff that like you worked your ass off, you're seriously depressed, all your social activities are like talking to your beer bottles, which has been me the past couple weeks, and I'm like, you know what'd be perfect? You know what'd be perfect right now, beer bottle? Let's watch a Rennie Harlan film. I'm tired. I need a break. I need Mindhunters, for instance. Which
everybody needs Mindhunters.
We'll get to later because that's like that's the film that was the treasure that we were striving for when we dove into this dumpster of Rennie Harlan.
It's a shining beacon of crap. But we'll get into that. But
what are we starting with?
We're starting with Prison. Because I figured we'll start at the beginning of his career.
Yeah.
To back when Rennie Harlan was just a scrappy little neophyte Finnish director looking for his big break. And
give me my break.
Prison was a horror film made in, I believe, 1988, I think.
Yeah.
It is a little piece set in a prison, given the name. It's rather surprising.
It's not a Fred Wiseman doc.
I kind of expected it to be set in an animal hospital, but yeah. It is actually set in a prison.
Okay. And it's not a Sarch drama or Beckett play.
It's
not Ionesco.
It's definitely a horror film. Yeah. About a prison that is haunted by some manner of electric force.
Oh, yes.
That is unleashed by, of all people, Viggo Mortensen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're going to have a ghost unleashed by anyone, I guess Viggo's a good
choice. Viggo Mortensen and his epic pompadour.
Yeah, and there's a... For all the ladies out there, if you're even vaguely interested in this film at the thought of Viggo Mortensen unleashing lightning... there's actually a pre-Eastern Promises shower scene with a young Viggo Mortensen... Where Dana, what's his name?
What, are we talking about the evil warden?
Yeah.
Lane
Price? Lane Andrews?
No, I want to say Lane Scott, but that's wrong.
Anyway. Where basically the warden of this prison is chewing out Viggo Mortensen, and he's having a shower, and they're glowering at each other, and he's like, I'll get you yet, Viggo Mortensen, I don't know how.
Lane Smith.
The deceased... But well-loved Lane Smith, whose name I couldn't recall on command. But the fact of the matter is, yeah, Viggo Mortensen's like, what, I'm naked, and I'm arguing with you, and I'm still suave as fuck. So just so you know, that could be a reason to see this film. But my main argument with this film is it's not very good because there's a lot of fun stuff to watch. There's a lot of ridiculous... explosions and effects that are generally over the top and ridiculous and the kind of thing that you want from a Rennie Harlan film. But the fact of the matter is, like, you could get those films too in a convenient 5-minute supercut YouTube clip and you'd think, wow, this movie is great.
Absolutely.
When in fact, all over the course of, what is it, 100 minutes, 101, something like that?
It's definitely a bit on the long side.
Wow, it's long.
I think the main problem is that, as Simon alludes to, it does have a lot of quote unquote cool parts, like, you know, the part where the solitary confinement cell turns into a furnace and burns this dude alive.
Oh yeah, that was
he's
cool.
Running around screaming and like,
the soles of his sneakers are melting.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great scene. Or the scene where the guard is sitting in the chair and then the barbed wire goes nuts and wraps around him and fires a shotgun at him. And, like, he's just attacked and killed by sentient barbed wire.
Or something.
And then as a topper, the barbed wire lifts him up, shoves him through the ceiling, through the floor.
Into the prison
mess
hall.
Into the prison warden's office.
Well, no, it's the mess hall.
No, it's the prison warden's office.
It's another body that's dumped in the mess hall?
Yes, it's another body that's dumped in the mess hall. That's the prisoner who tries to escape.
See, from what we're describing, that's a very...
It sounds like the coolest movie ever.
Yeah, right?
But the problem is that once you get past the good parts, you have to deal with the plot.
Yeah, and there is no plot.
There is no plot until there's about half an hour left in the film. Then it tries to fill in this vague backstory about an executed prisoner.
Yeah, it's very basic.
Who's also played by Viggo Mortensen, mainly in flashback. And
yeah, not in flashback, in a newspaper clipping.
Yes.
We don't even get the courtesy of a flashback.
It's just really sort of belabored and very poorly thought out. But
it reminds me of what I think we'll see throughout his career. Suggests that Rennie Harlan would have been an amazing music video director.
Absolutely.
Like, he seems like a poor man, very, very poor man's, like a Buck 05 poor man's version of David Fincher, almost, even though he totally doesn't have he's like the anti-Fincher in the sense that Fincher has, like, an insane, a very anal amount of, like, OCD control over everything he does, whereas, I think the Rennie Harlan ethos is basically, I'll try anything once.
Yeah, I think the Harlan ethos is the exact opposite of having utter, you know, like, OCD control. It's let's just take all these cool moments and then string them together and we'll fly by the seat of our pants and see what we can make out of this.
Yeah, he likes experimenting in that way.
And but what you're saying about, in terms of the music video, and I know that that can be thrown out, thrown around as a sort of an insult to certain styles of filmmaking, most notably the Platinum Dunes horror remake.
Oh, fuck those guys.
Yeah, fuck those films. But here it's actually a positive, because like the film has all these really deep, intense blacks, and everything is backlit by these blinding blue lights.
Yeah.
And you get these scenes like with the inexplicable scene with the guy trying to pray the demon away.
Yeah, and his guts shoot out from like a light.
Like, yeah, it's just like he's sitting there praying in the dark, and then all of a sudden this light explodes through his wall and hits him in this perfect circular pattern in the chest, and then blows out his back.
He farts out his guts.
Yeah, and pinions him to his cell.
Yeah.
His cell door. And this film is incidentally not as cool as we're making it sound.
Yeah.
And I just want to stress that the screenplay gets in its own way. It has this completely superfluous female character who every now and then shows up and doesn't even do us the courtesy of delivering exposition. She's just there to bitch out Wayne Smith.
Yeah, she's bitching him out and giving him the motivation to be a hard ass on the prisoners. Yeah. Who he's like, I don't know how you're doing it, but every other scene, I'm going to basically blame all this weird supernatural shit going on in here on you because people are writing my ass, and that person has to be the woman.
And I would just like to point out that this is actually written by a fellow named Erwin Yablans.
Wow.
Who only wrote one other film in his career, the beloved, much-remembered Roller Boogie.
Roller Boogie, yeah. What?
But he does have a measure of fame, and that's as one of the producers on Halloween.
Huh.
So the guy has a fairly impressive list of production credits. Mm-hmm. He's not a screenwriter.
Sure.
And I think that's the problem here.
But here's the thing. We were talking about how this seemed like outtakes from like a total Eclipse of the Heart knockoff music video. And the other thing, the other referent point is like where Vigo is like digging and they're like doing manual labor inside the prison and they're like expanding the basement, I guess, or something.
Yeah, that's how they unleash the evil, yeah.
Yeah, they dig in the wrong spot, basically, and like all this like hellish light comes out and the fire in the furnaces flare up and all this shit starts happening.
Wind and exploding glass. And
yeah, they found basically the Indian burial ground in the prison. And that scene, though, where like he's digging and that light pours out, I swear, man, it seems like outtakes from The Keep, you know, the Michael Mann film. And that's like the most like music video-y thing that Mann ever did, certainly. And it just seems like, you know, the kind of really like if a cinema du look filmmaker did like a Indiana Jones knockoff, that scene alone would like that's what that scene would look like, if you can imagine that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's interesting, but in an incidental kind of way. And like that goes back to Harlan's kind of "I'll try anything once" mentality. Like there's just stuff in there that like he's very he's like a small child. He's attracted to flashy things, to like to explodey things, to like things shooting out of other things, to like
I can't argue with any of this.
Exactly. Like
the point is that some of his projects make that a positive.
Yes, and he does that because he is such an instinctive filmmaker. He doesn't filter he doesn't filter himself to the point where he's like, no, I have to do this prerequisites. He's like, you know what? I'll try this. I'll give it a shot. And a lot of that stuff, like, it massages that reptilian part of your brain where it's like, yeah, that car blew up good because that corpse came out of the ground and that machine gun is firing on people with lightning.
I've been saying for years that Rennie Harlan is essentially the poor man's Paul Verhoeven.
No, absolutely.
They both make these ridiculously over the top, thoroughly violent, disreputable entertainments. But Verhoeven does it because he's a perverse son of a bitch, and B, because he's using it as a satiric sort of self-critical impulse against violence in entertainment and audience expectations and things like that.
I'd say that's a big butt, dude.
Rennie Harlan does it simply because he's a perverse son of a bitch.
Speaking of big butts,
he just likes sadistic, over the top violence.
Speaking of big butts, though, there's that great. There's a theme throughout these films that we watched today, where like guys,
Rennie Harlan is an arse man.
He's a massive arse man, and he is. There's a scene where like the prisoners are stuck in the prison yard while like the evil spirit in the prison has commandeered a machine gun and is firing it. Because, let's face it, he's a crack shot, this ghost. He's really good. The only thing stopping him is, you know, running out of bullets. But these guys are like, no, let me out. And one guy's like, please let me out, I'm going to die. And one of the prisoners is like, you got a lot to admit, man. You know, I'm like, this hardened criminal has got, like, enough humanity to say, you got to let this poor guy
live. Let's another hardened criminal in, yeah.
And he's like, fuck him. And the guy that's, like, basically being thrown to the wolves here is, like, he's pounding.
He's one of the prison yard sadists, so they can understand why they'd want him dead.
I guess.
Or at least not care about him.
I guess. But, like, the fact is that one of them did go out of his way to say, hey, he doesn't deserve that. Yeah. And there's, like, a pickaxe spontaneously lifts up, presumably because of the ghost, and it flies directly
into his corner,
expressly into his butt. It pins, it pins him right up the butthole, and it's like it's a quick shot from there. But we had to rewatch it just to make sure that's what we were watching.
Well, because there's an enormous continuity error there, because the pickaxe goes through the door on the other side.
Yeah, it goes up shoulder level, basically.
So, yeah, it nearly spears the guy who's holding the door in the head.
So either...
And the other prisoner isn't that tall.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's either... The other guy must be a midget. Tiny. Tiny.
Tiny little prisoner. But
no wonder he was so disgruntled. But anyway, yeah, the fact is, this is the first sign that Renny Harlin has a thing for butts. He likes butts.
He likes big butts, and he cannot lie.
Who can?
But he... It's I kind of pegged it early, and the film never really transcended beyond this. It's a really nice-looking film. It's really well-made. It's certainly better made than your average 80s slasher movie, which is what it is, just in supernatural garb. But it's a calling card.
In a prison, too.
Yeah.
You should add.
This is a movie that is flashily well-made for the sole purpose of a director going, hey, Hollywood, notice me. Look what I can do. Look what I can do on a low budget. I can make a film that looks like $1 million on $100,000.
But that's what distinguishes it in, like, what are we talking about The Covenant next?
I think we're moving on to The Covenant next.
The Covenant, he still has that mentality, I think. And that's why I think that I'll Try Anything Once is definitely the Renny Harlin motto, because he's still definitely, by the time he made The Covenant, which is 2006, like, you know, almost two decades after Prison, he's still very much a guy that's like, let's throw shit at a wall and see what sticks.
Yeah. And the Covenant, I get the feeling, is kind of I get the feeling it's a paycheck gig. It's something he made because he had nothing else to do and he needed to do something.
I need the money, Lebowski.
Yeah, it's not a very Harlin film at all, honestly. Because one of the theses I wanted to present here is that Renny Harlin's cinema is essentially a war between his love of idiocy and his love of sadism. And his best films have a balance there. Like, they're stupid and they're mean, but there's a balance going on there.
There's a good scene, though, to talk about the stupidity, the streak of stupid in that film. There's a lot of stupidity in The Covenant.
The Covenant is definitely what happens when you take the mean out of Harlin. It's a PG-13 movie.
Very toothless, and the fact is there's, like, this... There's a scene, though, where at least he's trying to show that he has, like, he's joking around, or that he understands to a bit how silly what we're watching is. Because, like, basically the film follows a group of, like, four teen boys that are, like, warlocks, and they're at a party.
It's waiting for the CW.
Totally. Yeah, and they're at a party, and they're fronting in front of these girls, like, what? I'm tougher than you. No, I'm tougher. I'm blah, blah, blah. And then they just, like, they're, like, confronting each other, and there's one scene where, like, the tension is supposed to be so thick, like, you could cut it with, like, a, I don't know what kind of knife, but the point is, it's thick, the tension is very thick, and they basically, it's like a staring down contest, and one of the guys winds up, like, barfing, like, barfing on the other guy, well, that ended that confrontation. It's like, thanks, Renny. And it's that juvenile impulse, though, that's like, that's a Renny Harlin move.
It does lead into that great line of dialogue. His friend's puking sure came at an opportune time. Yeah, I tend to lay Harlin's direction in this is pretty lazy, and he's not good with the actors. I kind of think he works best with actors who do have a sort of self-contained persona.
Basically, and, people who are trying.
Yes, and
self-starters basically. So he,
yeah. He and here they, it's just a bunch of young people who don't know what they're doing. They'd look out of place on fucking Pretty Little Liars, for Christ's sake. They would get acted off the screen by those people.
Yeah,
it's like.
I'll give you an imitation of a line reading. There's a bit where these two warlocks are facing off, and one of them is like standing in the middle of the road, and the other is trying to rescue his like mortal, like i.e. not witch or warlocky girlfriend, and he's on a motorcycle, and the tension is supposed to be that like each time the evil warlock is egging on the good one, he revs his motorcycle, so like. The bad warlock is like, come to save Little Miss Muffet, have we? Well, you're too late. And then the engine revs like twice, and he's like, the way that he says this next bit is like he's got verbal diarrhea. He's like, a spider came and sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away.
Yeah, and incidentally, that line is delivered by the villain, who is absolutely awful.
Oh, bad.
He couldn't intimidate, you know, a five-year-old girl. If you were to set a pig in front of him, the pig would be the more frightening.
He'd just be laughing, yeah.
Yeah, he's really, really awful. And everyone in this film is awful. And that part is definitely Harlan's fault. But the ultimate problem with this film is the dumb, retarded fucking screenplay.
Oh, my God.
The screenplay in this was written by one J.S. Cardone.
But if you
know anything about crap cinema, he's the guy who did The Forsaken, which...
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah,
have I seen that?
The Forsaken, I think, is kind of fun. It's stupid. But then I guess Cardone decided to keep going with the stupid. And as pointed out to me by Alex Fung later, he most recently has written both the remakes of Prom Night and The Stepfather.
Fuck that.
So this is a guy who has clearly decided to stop trying.
Okay, but look, hold on. I remember now why I saw The Forsaken. The Forsaken, I only saw that movie because I was basically the target audience for that kind of shit. This is when the second Mummy, The Mummy Returns, came out, and I was still in my, I'm going to sneak into movies because I'm too young to get into R-rated films. And I was like, my friends and I saw The Mummy Returns, and I was like, I thought I was like such a big guy. I was like, you know what? You guys go home to your little houses and co-ops. I'm going... to sneak into The Forsaken alone. You want to join me? What? No, of course you're not. You're not tough enough. And I saw The Forsaken, and I was like, man, this movie's bad.
It wasn't very good, but at the same time, I at least give it credit as a film that acknowledges its station in life as a shitty B-movie that exists just to show, you know, gore and tits. To the point where the credit sequence is... played over Isabella Miko in the shower.
Miko!
Washing blood off her tits.
Miko?
Yeah. I guess you don't remember that.
No. I think I did at the time, and I was like, this movie got interesting.
Yeah, it's like the film just sums up what it's about right there. It's like, blood and tits. Okay. Right on the title. Blood and tits.
But you were talking about shitty screenplays, yeah. And like... That's a hallmark of Rennie Harlanism, the idea that he'll take anything... And, like, we got another through line through these films is really bad puns and wordplay.
He generally chooses shitty screenplays, but when he's on, he'll choose a shitty screenplay that's at least shitty in a fun way.
But my point was, there's a lot of shitty wordplay and a lot of shitty puns because a lot of these screenwriters that Harlan teams up with like to think that they're being clever when, in fact, they're just being, like, hideously stupid.
You mean like the scene where the villain shouts out, "I'll make you my weeotch"?
Yeah. I also like by then he was such a bitter old man, or I guess I should say a bitter old young man. Fuck you.
Yeah, seriously.
Or when that one of the kids is like in like he's trying to act boastful, and because he's a warlock, he's like, Harry Potter can kiss my ass.
Oh, the delivery on that is priceless. Right before he drives the Jeep off the cliff.
Yeah.
Harry Potter can kiss my ass! It puts me back in mind of Clint Eastwood in The Iger Sanction. up on the mountain screaming, "You asshole!"
But it's Clint Eastwood versus some kid, you know?
And Clint Eastwood would kick the fuck out of him. I don't care how many magic powers this kid has. But it's... And the thing is, There was... I ultimately really don't like this movie, because it's stupid.
I'm not defending that.
But there's something about it that keeps me from hating it, in that the main crux of the film is this young kid is about to turn 18, and he's going to, quote, ascend. At which point, you know, he gets the real magic powers. He's got like little fucking, you know, nothing powers now.
But those powers come at a cost. It's like, yes, the more you use it, it ages you.
Yeah. And that's an interesting idea. I think a good film could do something really interesting with that idea.
But we're talking about a running.
But we're talking we're talking about a J.S. Cardone script even more than we're talking.
And
about
no. You have to. This is what I object to. You're creating a false dichotomy that there's a difference between a Cardone film and a Harlan film.
There is.
And to me, there isn't, because the fact is, Harlan is he's like Pac-Man. He'll whatever he eats is that's his film. He'll take anything on. He'll eat anything. He's a crap cinema omnivore. He'll do anything, and he'll if it's something that'll help him with his career, fine. If it's something that'll help him make money, fine. If it's something that will help appease some part of him that's I want to make sure this project, sure. It's, you know, it's all the same. It's all Renny Harlan.
I don't think he would have taken Prom Night.
I think he would have if they did something for him.
There's nothing to Prom Night. There's nothing interesting at all about it.
What, and there's something to The Covenant?
I just told you. I thought there was at least an interesting idea there. And I think the film is interestingly directed. And, you know, Harlan gets to use his blacks. The film is
If there's an interesting idea behind that film, that's Cardone's idea. He didn't do the screenplay.
I'm not necessarily knocking that part. I'm saying that there was something interesting in the screenplay that let him take it, or that led him to take it. More so than there would be something interesting in The Stepfather.
You're projecting here. You don't know that. That's the reason why he chose that.
You're right, I don't. But I think it provides a through line to our fucking podcast if I try to defend that, doesn't it?
Specious.
All specious you, mister.
Specious.
Specious you.
You're one. Okay.
Anyway. And this film also has a shower scene that runs about 5 minutes long, and there's no titty in it.
Yeah.
I would just like to say that.
And there's a lot of weird shower stuff. He's got a shower. That's another.
He likes showers, yeah.
He likes showers, but he doesn't do much with them.
And it also ends with...
Isn't this an R-rated film, too?
No, it's PG-13. Hmm. And it also ends with a Street Fighter adaptation that is at least more faithful than The Legend of Chun-Li.
What are we talking about?
The Covenant. Come on, totally.
When?
The climax of that is the two wizards throwing fucking Hadoukens.
Oh, the Hadoukens, yeah. It's basically, there's a hideously, prolonged scene where these guys are just throwing, little pockets of air balls. They're throwing air balls at each other.
They're fucking Hadoukens.
And they are Hadoukens, but the fact of the matter is, it's basically two, CW characters chucking air at each other. Yeah. And it's the most
so bad.
Boring thing. But it's then again, so it's got the Renny Harlan,
it's still stylishly directed.
If you can make out what's going on, because it's so pitch black in that barn.
But the fact is, lit enough to see what's going on.
Yeah, there's stuff blowing up. That's the thing.
Exactly.
That's Renny Harlan. I got stuff blowing up.
Oh, wait, I need lights in this film? What's lighter with explosions?
Yeah. Well, it's not even explosions. If there were explosions, it'd be fire, and it'd be fun to look at, because fire is cinematic, folks.
If nothing else, Michael Bay understands that fire is cinematic.
Fire is pretty. Fire good. Fire good.
Fire and, boom.
Fire nice. And the point is, here it's just air is going, there's wood, he's going to get a splinter, oh no.
The barn's on fire.
After 5 minutes.
A whole 5 minutes.
Yeah, a 5 minute scene of two kids just chucking air at each other? Are you fucking kidding me, Carlson? Fuck.
Excuse me, dude, we're going to have to go fist fight now.
Okay. We're back in the fist fight, guys. This is the most intense fight ever. There's a bunch of air shooting around. Woo!
It was amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And I'd also like to point out that this is probably the only Teen Witch film that gives a completely random shout out to Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, there's a class that's being taught in like modern contemporary lit, and it's like, we're going to be reading such authors as Cormac McCarthy. Who's the second author?
I don't know.
Second author, I forget, and then Stephen King.
Yeah.
Stephen King, and one of them's like,
Dreamcatcher was the shit!
And he's like, no, I'll be doing The Shining, which incidentally, I just read. But it's like the idea that there's like a delineation between like quality Stephen King and poor quality Stephen King, which there is.
There absolutely is.
Have
you read Dreamcatcher?
But I just love that assumption that in the screenplay, like, there was at some point a thinking presence that was like, yeah, I'm just going to casually drop this here. And an audience of, like, know-nothing teens is going to get that, or not even thinking that far ahead. It's just, like, they'll just, it'll go over their heads, and it'll be something. Like, there was, at some point, like, a personal impulse that was just, like, yeah, there definitely is a difference between, in quality between Dreamcatcher and Shining. And it's, like, why couldn't they have applied that intelligence to, you know, the fucking narrative? God!
I just have to wonder what Cormac thinks of that. I hope someone alerted him to it. I really do.
If anyone listening to this knows Cormac McCarthy, can you please tell him to watch The Covenant? And just don't tell him why. Just say, Cormac, if I may call you Cormac, please watch this film.
I think it'll give you ideas.
That's a reason, damn it. Didn't you hear me? I said no reasons. Anyway.
But then he won't do it.
Fuck no, he'll do it. He's probably like, ooh, young teen witch boys. I love it.
And that's the thing. Look at that log line. That's basically a David Duchovny film.
What's that?
He's the he's the guy who works for Charles Band Full Moon. He makes basically his whole thing is making films with young men. A lot of times they're warlocks or they're being possessed by zombies or werewolves or whatever.
Warlock?
And the thing is, it's always a group of young dudes because David Duchovny wants to get them all shirtless because David Duchovny is gay.
So he's Gus Van Sant if he worked with Charles Band.
Basically, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Incidentally, we're going to go on an obscure tangent from it.
The Covenant is basically a David Duchovny film without all the homoeroticism.
Interestingly enough, there's in Hong Kong, there's like a group of guys, like a small collective of like supernatural horror filmmakers or... like one of the guys that did this movie called Womb Ghosts, which has such a great title, Womb Ghosts, and they're apparently like notoriously gay, or they're at least like that's one of their hallmarks.
Notoriously gay.
Yeah, they're infamously gay because it's like they make these movies that are like they have homoeroticism and they're rightfully proud that they're gay and that they're making movies that fit their interests, and it's just kind of interesting that like that kind of thing that is now like. A small niche. I like the fact that like there's that niche now, and it's kind of fascinating because the Hong Kong film market isn't necessarily the most accommodating one. So anyway, I find that interesting that there's now like supernatural gay films.
I will have to check out one of these Womb Ghost movies.
Well, I don't know if there's sequels. I have Womb Ghosts here if you want to watch that at some point.
Guys, we're going to take a break now. The rest of this podcast is just going to be us watching Womb Ghosts.
Womb Ghosts?
I hope you're okay with that.
I wonder if that one... anyway, let's move on.
Anyway, so The Covenant is a film that definitely falls on the stupid without the sadism line of the divide.
Yes.
And the next film we're going to talk about certainly falls on that too, just on a much grander scale.
Yes, and the film is Cutthroat Island.
Yes.
The film that...
The film that sunk Carol Co.
Yeah. That sounds like a feat unto itself. Anyway,
hey, they have all those Terminator $2, man. That's a lot of money there.
Anyway, Cutthroat Island is a film starring Matthew Modine. Enough said. Yeah. No, yeah, it's a film with...
Oh, Matthew Modine.
It's he's got a bunch of people, though.
He's
it's
like
got,
a blander Cary Elwes.
Oh, yeah, you suck the fun out of Cary Elwes, you get Matthew Modine. It stars Gina Davis with a monkey on her shoulder. It stars a scene chewing, regurgitating, and then chewing again, Frank Langella.
And somehow it's not the best movie ever made.
And no wait,
and it's got pirates.
It's got pirates. It's got like Dino De Laurentiis level production values. And fuck tits. Who else is in this film?
Maury Chaykin. Yeah.
Maury Chaykin's in this. Although that's not a plus. That's a minus, dude.
Harris Yulin's in the beginning.
Someone else. Oh, yeah. It's got the eldest brother from Malcolm in the Middle in it.
That's not a plus.
Yeah, you're right.
Dude, did you see the Strange Currencies series? That's not a plus.
No, I didn't see it.
Strange Frequencies, sorry. Strange Currencies is an R.E.M. song.
Yeah, I like that song.
It's a good song.
But, yeah, so this movie is also a film that I know as one that helped put a couple nails in the coffin of Paul Verhoeven's erotic pirate thriller adventure story film.
It was supposed to be an erotic pirate thriller?
Well, yeah, I hear
like
there was...
Basic Instinct on the High Seas?
I heard he was approaching some actress, I forget who it was, and he was like, all right, you're going to be bare-chested. And she's just like, oh, okay, wait, what? What? My tits are out? What? I can't deal with this.
If anybody listening to this can corroborate this story, maybe provide, you know, provide the source for it.
I'll find it for you. Just Google tits, Paul Verhoeven pirates. And I'm sure it'll find it.
I'm sure that'll, bam. That'll come results. Up with so many different results.
20 hits. Easy. But, Anyway, the point is, it's one of those infamous films that were never made.
Right.
And the fact that this perfectly forgettable pirate adventure film, which plays out like sort of like if you take all the Verbinski-ness out of the first Pirates of the Caribbean, you might get this, like a very perfectly bland and way too long film, you'd have Cutthroat Island, which it has little flourishes of what we were talking about, sadism, including we were talking about how there's a butt fetish. There is another scene in this film where a guy gets cornholed. Yes. A guy gets cornholed with a cutlass up the butt.
It totally happens. It does.
And we were incredulous. We were like, this can't be happening. We gotta rewind and watch this in slow motion, no less. And it happens.
It did. A pirate gets a cutlass in his bum bum.
My gosh. My gosh, a Freddy Got Fingered reference.
Oh, yeah. You can put it in your bum bum.
This podcast is delivering like nothing else. Spitting that cold for you people.
A day where I don't reference Freddy Got Fingered is a day without sunshine.
It's a day wasted. but yeah, so the point is, this movie is it's just there, actually.
It's a big Elephantine production that it never quite gets off the ground.
Because I feel like Harlan's hands were tied behind his back. Like, he just wasn't allowed to, like...
You could tell there are certain sequences where, like, you know, like, say, like, cutlass in the butt. Or
the scene where a guy gets beheaded where his, like, head is stuck between the spokes of, like, a ship steering wheel.
It's like, you can tell there he wanted to cut loose, but at the same time, he was probably contractually obligated to deliver a PG-13. So there was only so far he could go with some of the nastiness.
Yeah, the Langella character is so memorable because there are a couple lines that he has where he has to be nasty and prove how nasty he is. Like, where one guy's like, no, we can't pull up anchor, Frank Langella. We don't have enough food for the journey. And he's like,
we need fewer mouths.
Yes, and he shoots the guy, and he's like, didn't I tell you to cut the anchor? I'll do it myself. And it's like, oh, no, he's going to do it himself. He just cut the anchor. And it's like it's such a winning character because like Langella's character seems to be like a repository for all the Rennie Harlan-ness of the film.
Yeah,
like he takes a lot of that bad behavior, that raging like 5-year-old sense of like I want it now and I'm gonna do it now. Exploding ship, woman Gina Davis swinging across the room on a chandelier, shot underneath the ship when they're fighting each other. Cannon fire, fuck.
And that chandelier swing that you just cited, incidentally, is the most listless chandelier swing anyone has ever felt.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Like, it just clearly is like, what if I tried this? What if I tried this chandelier scene? It's automatically cool because it's a chandelier swing, and it's like, it's kind of boring.
Yeah, it didn't work. I think that's my problem with Cutthroat Island, in that it's clearly being designed as a mass market product, and the energy level in it it's too low. Especially for you know, those of us who are used to watching something like, say, Deep Blue Sea, and know this guy's more famed works like this, or the Long Kiss Goodnight, the film he followed this up with.
Yeah.
Which are just, you know, just all mania, all the time.
Yeah. He's basically being restrained, possibly by, you know, probably by the the requirements to deliver product.
Nobody wants a restrained Lenny Harlan.
Lenny Harlan? Is he his brother?
Is his brother, yes.
I'm Lenny Harlan.
The point of Lenny Harlan is to be the exact opposite of restrained. To just go bug fuck.
Yeah, and then that's the thing. Like, Gina Davis's character is introduced with an ass shot, but it's not even an ass shot. It's like, you see her back, and like, you begin to see the curve of her buttocks, and it's like, that's a butt. I just saw a butt. I think I saw a butt, but I didn't actually see a butt. I saw the hint of a butt. And it's like, that's not
the suggestion of a butt.
Yeah, the intimations of a butt. And it's like, that's not good enough, Rennie.
No. It's
where's my butt?
It's getting a cutlass stuck in it.
That's not the right butt.
No.
That's not the right butt, Rennie.
I give it credit. It does what it came to do. It's a pirate movie, and it's kind of satisfying on that level. I think it, and it does keep the, you know, kind of keep moving. Mm-hmm. It never really stops to elaborate a plot per se. There's always something going on, but it's kind of half speed, and it's kind of a, I don't know, it's very genre bound in a way that doesn't feel useful. You know, it's like, oh, we're making a pirate movie. Well, what do we need for a pirate movie?
Yeah, really. It's
well,
like,
you need
it's
maps,
like, I need
pressure.
Three eggs and, yeah. You know, flour. And
yeah, it's like somebody was trying to bake a pirate
an
movie.
An invisible
now.
Gina Davis ass shot.
Yes,
and, you know,
yes.
These things just, they don't work.
It never quite hits the level of inspiration that it needs.
Yeah, fuck Betty Crocker, Rennie Harlan cinema. We want real Rennie Harlan cinema.
Yes.
No ersatz Rennie Harlan cinema.
Yes, we want Mindhunters.
Yes, which brings us to a happiest moment in this podcast when we get to talk about Mindhunters. Yes. Mindhunters! Mindhunters!
Mindhunters is a movie where Rennie finally gets to... Is the movie we're going to talk about, the one where Rennie finally gets to hit the balance correct.
Now, just to give you an idea of when this film is made, it's in 2004. The film is, to set the stage, Val Kilmer, who is briefly in this film, is still not Fatty Kilmer. He doesn't have the hamster cheeks. He is eating a piece of cake, and you have, at one point, I was like, so that's how he became Fatty Kilmer. This is it. He was just hanging around the craft services table for this film, and that's how it happened.
That's how he became Fatty Kilmer.
Fatty Kilmer begins. So this is that point. LL Cool J is still in Rennie Harlan films. He was also in Deep Blue Sea, if you recall, as the guy that has like a weird, he's being tempted by God in Deep Blue Sea. And there's that great scene in Deep Blue Sea where he's like trying to get out of the ship and like God's testing his like more obsessive neurotic tendencies by putting like a pornographic magazine floating in the water. And he sees it and he's like, no, must live, get away from the pornography, escape temptation. So, anyway, that's
his
Harlan loves LL Cool J. That's what I'm trying to say.
He loves LL Cool J.
And so
his morality is like a shark fin.
Anyway, so there's Kilmer, there's them, there's who else is in this film? Who else is in this film?
Christian Slater.
Yeah, he's whatever.
Johnny Lee Miller.
Christian Slater's the first one to die. Fuck that guy.
Ian Bailey. Patricia Velasquez.
All these names, I can't.
Oh, then you suck. I'm sorry.
I can't do this. Anyway,
well, fine. Get the fuck out of here!
I'm going out the window. No,
Oh, and Clifton Collins Jr. How can I forget him?
Yeah.
He's great, and I always like seeing him in movies because he's just terrific constantly.
But yeah, so Mindhunters. Mindhunters is the kind of film that, it's like I described it on Twitter, and I think this is rather apt, which is why I'm quoting Twitter, for fuck's sake, that it's basically what a Saw movie aspires to be. It's basically a bunch of really stupid, illogically strung together traps that are, like combined by, like, a very, like, stunted, imaginatively stunted, I should say, mind that thinks that they're a lot smarter than they are. It's like, you know what make a cool trap? or make a cool scene, they're two, the killer and the guy that he's chasing, and they're underwater, right? And they both are shooting at each other, but they can't kill each other because there's bullets whizzing, and it's all like, oh, it's slow motion, it's not enough to hurt him, when in fact it probably would. But still, they're like, oh, it's water, suspend your disbelief, bitch. And it's like they're shooting at each other, and it's like, well, one of them's got to go up top at some time to get water. I don't know. Oh,
that's the most awesome Mexican standoff ever.
It's awesome because
they're both underwater.
They're both at the surface of the water, and like one character has...
They both have their guns above the water, and the point is that they're waiting...
Whoever gets up to surface,
each other out to
yeah.
see who needs to breathe first.
Whoever surfaces first, naturally a bullet, even though they're not aiming their gun, will magically find them.
Damn right.
And it's like the killer obviously gets up first and gets shot. But still,
right in the neck.
Right in the neck. And it's like that kind of like kiddie intelligence is just like, oh yeah, it's so cool, it's gonna work. And it's like, oh, yeah. Holy shit, it is so cool.
It actually does work.
It's like Axe Cop. It's the kind of thing that's so stupid, you're just like, holy shit, amazing.
Like, imagine, like, if there was, like, a Rube Goldberg device where, like, all these dominoes were knocking shit down, and, like, this guy was standing and watching them, and they all led to this ball that knocked this tank over, but instead of, like, gasoline or something, or,
it's
like,
liquid air, nitrogen.
It's liquid nitrogen, and he just stands there, and his legs all freeze up, and then he breaks!
And his gut breaks up, and he's all like, whoa! And so, yeah,
Or, like, you know, this chick, she's got, like she has to smoke.
It's got chutzpah. Yeah. Put it that way, to quote Matt Zoller Seitz's review of Guy Ritchie's Revolver, you can say what you want, but this movie's got chutzpah.
It's stupid and crass and sadistic.
Insanely entertaining!
And it doesn't care.
Oh my god.
Back when I used to write reviews, I think I summed it up as crawler cinema. It's the kind of film you watch when you know you want something that's bad for you, but you don't want something that's going to be too heavy on calories.
Basically. I like that. Yeah. I like that. Because, yeah, like, for instance, it's like a thinking man's film for stupid man. And, like,
it's
no, hold on. There's that bit where it's trying to show you that there's, like, logic to this. There's, like, more than just, like, knee-jerk, I'm making this up as I go logic. And there's, like, a scene where they're trying to say, like, well, this is how the killer is targeting these, by the way, there's a plot in this film. It's basically a bunch of guys a bunch of FBI agents that are profiling serial killers get hunted by a serial killer. Ooh, how novel.
It's a CSI set on an island. And
on crack!
If William Peterson was a killer.
Crack! Anyway, so they're like trying to figure out, like, what's the pattern here? What's the killer doing? And he's like, well, he's exploiting our weaknesses. All of us have weaknesses. And it's like, what's one of these guys' weakness is, like, he's a coffee junkie.
Yeah.
That's it. He gets, this is the best part. The killer exploits the fact that he's a coffee junkie by draining all the blood out of this guy's body
after
drugging this guy's coffee just because he fucking likes coffee.
And that's the thing, that wasn't even something that was necessarily targeted at him. Everybody drinks the coffee.
Yeah.
They all pass out.
But he does that just to get the...
Well, yeah, I mean, he does it to buy himself time to go set up all his other shit, but... It's
and
like,
to kill the guy, drain the guy of blood.
And to drain his blood. Right, you know, on the walls, all the numbers and shit.
Or, like, this one guy is like, I never leave my gun behind me. And he, like, he does that... He, like, the killer rigs
his gun.
The guy's gun so that it backfires.
And shoves the slide right through his brain. Yeah.
That's what I love. It's assumed that basically the guy that's going to be firing the gun is like, he's going to be holding it,
face, yeah.
Or it's holding it somewhere in front of himself rather than just like, wow!
That's clearly not the gun that's meant for the underwater Mexican standoff.
I just realized that I did a completely non-helpful comment by saying that he's not holding it in front of himself like, wow. And you can't see that my hand's like wandering around me. But that's the kind of giddy, just...
And you haven't even mentioned the
dumb glee that this film instills. It's so good.
You haven't even mentioned the scene where LL Cool J has to walk across an electrified floor. And he does it by taking a gun and shooting bullet holes in...
Handholds, yeah.
In a wall, in like a plaster wall, that are all... Every single one is aimed exactly where it needs to be for his foothold, where he can kick out a foothold and climb on the wall.
Yeah, it's one of those requisite moments where it's like, LL Cool J proves that he's the man.
He's beyond the man.
Yeah, he's like he's doing like a low rent De Niro impression at times, and it's kind of ridiculous.
And the, you know, the thing is, this is a yet another film that's really really well made. Like
in sense,
in terms of a technical sense, like I think it's really well directed. There's a lot of interesting juxtaposing cuts made in the film. Sometimes just to get a laugh, sometimes because Harlan thinks it creates an interesting image. My favorite is the scene where Trisha Velasquez and Christian Slater meet each other in the shower, and they start having shower sex, and it immediately cuts to one of the other characters, sweaty and shirtless, doing push-ups in another room. It's like,
back to the ass, obsession, there is an unusual shower scene in the film where Christian Slater's like, oh, I'm touching myself in the shower, I'm lathering. And we see Christian Slater's ass, and it's like, you know, if they're an actual thinking director that wasn't just like flying by the seat of his pants, someone other than Rennie Harlan, basically,
yeah,
you'd be seeing a woman's butt. Instead, it's like, what's more erotic than Christian Slater's butt, man? I'm Rennie Harlan. I'm out. Yeah, and it's like, okay, fuck.
Yeah.
And that's the best part, because, like, his Christian Slater's girlfriend comes up to him, and they start playing with each other, and she has this, like, silly, like, chromatic, like, just, like, what's the word I'm thinking of, like, caveman version of, like, a screwball comedy line, where she's like, you only want me for my mind.
It's like, yeah. Well, the dialogue in this is just priceless. It's what you were talking about earlier, where it's all puns and self-referential nonsense.
Yeah, and they're talking about, because everyone's trying to figure out, what's our weakness? What's going to be exploited? And LL Cool J says,
we figured out his weakness.
Yeah, bullets. And I was like, in that pause, that pregnant pause, before he says bullets, I was like, bullets. And he's like, bullets. I was like, yes!
Yeah!
Bullets!
Guitar solo! Yeah, it's,
Yes.
But, we should probably move on to the grab bag. But that's, essentially, if you're watching Rennie Harlan's movies, you're looking for something like Mindhunters. Something stupid and nasty and fun.
Mindhunters.
And when he's on his game, that's kind of what he does. But when he's not, oh boy, clear the room.
Mindhunters.
And we didn't watch Exorcist at the beginning, thank the fuck Christ.
I suggested it.
Yes, I've seen it. It's not good.
Ow. Anyway.
You can fly solo on that one, bud. Sorry. That's
maybe I will. Just to spite me.
That's a Harlan film that has the sadism without the silliness. No, it's not. I kind of gave up on the film 20 minutes in when a jackal tears a boy apart.
Wow, that sounds great.
No, it's not.
Anyway.
It's really, really awful.
So, now's the portion in our part of our show where we do the Netflix grab bag feature.
Yep.
Which, if you're joining us for the first time, Netflix grab bag, the idea behind it is that we have really long queues, both of us, because we love movies.
And we have very Catholic tastes.
Oh, very.
Small C, not big C.
Okay. I didn't assume that we meant we were Catholics. Hi, Victor Morton!
Well, I thought he might assume, you know?
Victor! He's not listening to this.
No, he isn't.
My point is, Netflix grab bag. We basically, over the course of any given year, we add a lot of stuff to our queue that we're like, oh, that sounds good, and we don't usually get to it because, like, how often can you say, oh, I'm in the mood for half the stuff in your queue, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the downfall of being obsessive and compulsive and being able to just make lists like that. And Netflix grab bag basically lights a fire under our collective ass to pick randomly four titles from our respective queues. Like, we switch off each month. And so this month it was chosen from Steve's instant queue.
Yep.
And we chose four titles at random. And we have you, listeners, kind, gentle, generous listeners, who vote. And you decide what we watch, because, you know, we're not going to be able to decide based on, like, anything else that, like, oh, these four titles, what should I watch? It's not a mood thing. It's entirely a matter of, well, someone do a put a shotgun against our heads and make us watch one of these films.
Yeah. And our our picks for this month were Mega Shark versus Giant Octopus, the Sci-Fi Channel nonsense
with no Urkel.
With no Urkel, The Immaculate Conception of Little Dizzle, which oddly enough I heard someone talking about on an old Scarecrow podcast just about a week ago.
It got a lot of votes. It got like three or four votes. By a lot of votes, it said three or four.
And
you need to vote for this stuff, guys. Please.
Screen Time, horror anthology film, which also got votes.
Trauma.
Mega Shark got none.
Yeah, I didn't get any votes. All the others did, though. It was a nice spread.
But none of them got as many votes as the film that we ended up watching.
Yes, obviously. This film is Olivier Assayas' Irma Vep, which is a little film that you might you probably haven't heard of. It's a very obscure film. It's pretty well known. Compared to the other films on this list, this movie's like
it was
Citizen Kane,
the best known of the four films. But yeah, so Irma Vep.
I should start off by saying
thank you all for picking that one. Incidentally, it's a
great.
It was pretty good. I enjoyed it.
For me, there are filmmakers that I find that are so idiosyncratic that, try as I might to get into their works, you know, I could see X amount of films and still not find my gateway into their work. And Assayas, for me, was that kind of person. And Irma Vep, I think, opened...
Is that like, how you say it? Assayas?
I hope so. Because I've been saying that for a couple years. Anyway.
I just always thought it was Assayas, but then again, I don't speak
Assayas. So. Assayas! Anyway, so...
You make him sound like a fairy.
Yes. No, so let's just say Assayas because it sounds cool.
Assayas!
So, yeah, I was looking for the gateway into his work, and I think Irma Vep gave it to me. So I'm very grateful for that, and now I'm going to, like, try out films like Cold Water and
Demon Lover. Watch Demon Lover.
Because now I feel like I'm on the same wavelength, and I get it, because to me, Irma Vep is what you get when Olivier Assayas makes his own version of Day for Night, Truffaut's movie about making movies and what it's like to make movies and, like, the romance and frustration of making movies. And Irma Vep takes that and basically shows you that when you make a movie, every individual making the film is only able to look outside of their own respective roles and their own respective goals for the part. So, like, Maggie Chung's character, because Maggie Chung was Assayas' wife at the time, is this enigmatic figure that plays the lead in this film. But she's sort of representative of the intuitive, sort of chaotic sense of, oh, okay, I can do this. What am I doing again? I'm not sure. What's my line? What's my role? What's my job here? I can't do much more than, like, whatever is immediately put in front of me in this project, but I'll do it, and I'll do it immediately, I'll do it willingly, but once you start asking me questions beyond that, I'll give you a blank look and smile politely and just be like, I don't understand. And that to me, it creates a lot of compelling little, dramatic sort of, confrontations, little micro confrontations between characters that are, like, the director, played by Jean-Pierre Léaud, Truffaut, regular, who, he plays the director of the film within the film, and he's, like, he's got this vision that he can't make happen, and no one understands it, and, the guy that winds up replacing Léaud's character is, like, why a Chinese woman? I don't understand that. To me, Chinese women are, you know, Fu Manchu. It doesn't fit the story that they're trying to do.
There's this quintessentially French thing.
Yeah.
And incidentally, the guy who plays the director that replaces Léaud is played by Luc Castel from Fists in the Pocket. The lead in that.
Marco Bellocchio.
Yeah, Marco Bellocchio, yeah.
His first film. I love that film.
It's a good film.
It's a great film. And I think the line that sort of sums up that kind of tunnel vision that all these characters has is the news has just come out that after rehearsing with Maggie Chung's character, one actor is very eager to get on with the day's shoot, and a woman comes in and tells him, oh no, we're not shooting, the director can't come, it's not gonna happen, the project's over. And he's like, what about my scene? Yeah. And he's just like, that's like, he just blurts it out. I'm thinking, he's like, what about, what do I do? I don't, like, you just cut the floor out from under me. What?
Well, and there's a lot of that in the film. There's a lot of that in general in a lot of Olivier's films. He does tend to deal in a lot about a lot of films about disconnection, about problems of communication, the breakdown therein, and how it's difficult to make oneself understood. And you do get a lot like the scene where they're talking about where they're designing the costume, and Maggie Cheung asks the costume designer, "Are you sure this is what Renee wants?"
Yeah.
Or the I'm not sure where they're at the party, and there's that great scene of dialogue in the kitchen between Zoe, the costume designer, and her mom, where her mom's basically trying to talk her into seducing Maggie Cheung.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're talking about how she doesn't speak French.
Yeah.
Because Maggie Cheung is a Hong Kong actress who only speaks English and Cantonese, I guess. Or did she speak Cantonese or
Cantonese,
yeah.
She's from Hong Kong.
Yeah. And she speaks no French, understands no French.
Yeah.
And the line is, I'm not sure she understands everything I say.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just this systemic breakdown of communication between people, which ties into your idea about everyone paying attention to their own role.
Right.
And refusing to work as an organism. Instead of a group coming together to make one thing, it's a bunch of people working on their own little projects.
And yeah, and that's the thing, like, the ideal is posited as that there's, like, one group mind, hive mind on any given project, which is shown in these characters are watching some old political films that they made, but basically these political films.
I forget the name of the film, but it's a legit film, and the name of it pops up in the credits, and I forgot to write it down.
But basically it's about unions and solidarity between workers, and, like, it says that cinema is an inherently political tool that will help the proletariat basically break free of its bonds.
Cinema is not magic, it is art and science.
Yeah. And
that's written on a wall in the film.
And it can only basically, the implication is that it can only basically be used to help better class struggle. And that idea is that the ideal is that, you know, it's a communal experience. It's a communal,
yes.
It's groupthink, basically, but in a very politically empowering kind of way. And here it's sort of like, well, that dream is like, in constant flux, because that's the goal and that's what everyone's striving for, but it's pretty damn difficult to
get there.
Especially now because, and this is the reason why Maggie Cheung has to be the star, because Asaya is sort of positing the idea that this is like a transnational identity.
Yeah.
He has
multiple characters talk about the sorry state of French cinema.
Yeah.
You know, French cinema is dead, and you have that one, that hilarious scene with the interviewer.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's interviewing Maggie Cheung about the project.
And he says
he doesn't actually want to interview her. Like, he asks her, have you ever been in any John Woo films? No. And then he proceeds to start talking about how much he loves John Woo films anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
He's interviewing her as an excuse to talk about what he loves.
Yeah. Yeah, he talks
and
about
And then
John
he starts
Woo
running Woo. Down French cinema like, oh, don't you think the
That's
Renee...
That's outmoded. That doesn't
yeah,
work.
Don't you think Renee is over? I mean, French cinema is just so moribund, you know? It's a really great scene. I think it's a really great movie, but...
I do, too, and
getting back to the idea of the communal experience, what's interesting about this is that, you know, you have all this friction and this tension, and nobody's working together, everyone's kind of working at cross purposes, and yet you still have at the end where something has been made out of the dailies, and they project the new director who takes over, takes over and is looking at the dailies that Renee was able to shoot and edit, and it's this avant-garde object that the film turns into. Like, it's very, very reminiscent of, there's animation drawn in the frame that reminds me of Robert Breer. There's a touch of Brackage in there.
Oh, very Brackage. Yeah. Very, yeah, that's true, where it's, like, you're working on the print itself.
Yeah.
To change the meaning of the text.
Yeah. And there's a, text, there's a certain, you know, there's a certain amount of the idea. It's not exact, but the idea of de forma. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that, but you know, the idea of taking something and making something else out of it.
Sure.
You know, because meaning is always fluid. And it's just this idea that all this friction and this fractiousness and, you know, Leon's nervous breakdown all gets literalized into this beautiful, affecting object d'art.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, because you can read into it all that. You can certainly...
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And that's, like, that's the tipping, that's the Well, it's not. That's the thing. It's not a resolution for the film because that implies that like they achieve their goal.
Going to be left.
Yeah, that's that's like the end point that they're striving for. But at the end, it's like you're left with this mysterious object that like it's hard, it's impossible to read, but it's bewitching and it's something that they all made, and it's ideal of using cinema as a politically motivated tool becomes,
it's a
what's it basically.
There's still something there to show for their efforts.
Yeah,
and it's a really interesting and viscerally effective something too.
Yeah,
the sound mix in particular is fucking terrific on that, but also in the film in general.
Yeah.
Because Olivier does use a lot of Altman type overlapping dialogue. Which achieves a sort of secondary purpose when you consider that oftentimes people are talking in multiple languages.
Right.
So you'll have one conversation going on in English and then another one over here in French, and he'll switch back and forth between the conversations. And I don't know of any directors working today who use music as effectively as he does. His use of the Gainsbourg, Bonnie and Clyde,
yeah,
in particular, is just like, oh, it's really good.
It's pretty, yeah, he's certainly a filmmaker that knows his tastes, and he knows how to sort of intuitively use them,
yeah,
and it to great effect. Like, you just hear it, and it's like, it just fits with whatever scene, like, it just,
yeah,
it shapes the scene, too, and it's
and there's that, and there's that great scene, and it's not like a, like, because you do get a lot of that in, say, you know, Hollywood films with, you know, like pop songs that like, say, Under Pressure gets used a lot.
Dun, 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 dun.
Or, like, there's songs that can, that are being used as shorthand, like, I Feel Good, to fill in an emotional beat.
Yeah.
Here, when, you know, when Olivier does that, he's using Tunic, the Sonic Youth song about Karen Carpenter. It's in that scene where Maggie Chung puts on the cat suit and actually goes and steals something from the hotel, from someone else's hotel room, in the staying in the same hotel as her. But the song has the chorus, "You ain't never going anywhere," and it just hits at that idea that she's on this set and she doesn't know what she's doing anymore, and no one else in the film really knows what they're doing either.
Right.
So it's just this rare example of using music as a leading device that actually works.
Yeah, it's sort of like the exception that proves the rule in that sense. But let's say.
But what, yeah. So anyway, Irma Vep is awesome, and thank you.
Yeah.
Thank all of you who voted for it.
Thank you. But yeah, let's see what our options for next month's podcast Netflix grab bag votes are. This time we're taking it from my disc, like the DVD queue. And what are our options, Vanna?
Well, our options are Portrait of Jenny. The William Dieterle. Dieterle?
The director of such films as Salome with Rita Hayworth and a bunch of other actually better films, including, did he do Ben-Hur? Oh, wait, hold on.
I don't know. But it's got Joseph Cotten as a struggling artist, and Jennifer Jones as a woman
he did the Devil and Daniel Webster, by the way.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, the one with John Huston as Old Scratch, right?
Yes.
Or Mr. Pitch, or whatever he was called in that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so it's got Jennifer Jones as this mysterious woman, and Joseph Cotten as this struggling artist who becomes inspired by her to sketch her, and I've heard it's really good, so I'm definitely interested in it.
Yeah, I am too, particularly for that cast, Jennifer Jones and Joseph Cotten.
Yeah.
The second film is The Macintosh Man, a film directed by John Huston.
Yes.
Starring Paul Newman, I believe, right?
Paul Newman as a British spy.
So it's a John Huston directed Paul Newman starring espionage film from the early 70s, which, let's be honest, it sounds awesome.
It does.
I don't even know anymore. I'm down with that one. The third one is The Man Behind the Scissors.
Man Behind the Scissors is a Japanese, they call it on Netflix, a psychological thriller, but it's basically about a serial killer and his, like, girlfriend who find out that, like, they're about to do their thing, basically, and they find out that there's, like, a copycat serial killer out there, so to, like, clear their names, they have to figure this out, and presumably their killings involve, like, scissors.
But then again, I don't think any of you are going to vote for it, so...
Prove him wrong, guys. Tell Steve Carlson where to stick it. Vote overwhelmingly for this.
For The Man Behind the Scissors.
Flawless victory for this film. Come on. Anyway.
Toasty!
Shut up. I made a Mortal Kombat reference, and I don't want anyone to recognize it. Damn it!
The last film that was on Simon's queue, for reasons unbeknownst to me, is Once Bitten. The Lauren Hutton, Jim Carrey vampire comedy.
I put it on there because I had no interest in seeing it until a good friend of mine, he recommended it pretty actively, and he's like, oh, it's so funny. And some of the lines that he was mentioning, I was like, that sounds pretty funny. I'll give that a shot.
That's fair.
So I said, sure, let's give it a try. And I like young Jim Carrey when he was like... young and spazzy, as opposed to old and spazzy.
And looking at you with those big, shrink-wrapped in tears eyes that make him look like a poor man's Robin Williams.
Yeah, and he's got long... Anyway, the point is, young Jim Carrey is preferable. Young Jim Carrey, as in the Earth Girls Are Easy stage of his career.
He is incidentally not aging very well.
So bad.
His face looks like a roadmap now.
Really ugly roadmap. Like, he looks like Pizza the Hut. Pizza the Hut.
I was thinking more along the lines of that. Like, you remember when in The Frighteners, when Jeffrey Combs takes off his shirt and there's all this. His face is a roadmap of pain.
I wish you had said that, because that's all I'm going to be thinking of.
Every time you see Jim Carrey now.
I'm just going to think, like, I'm going to see old man Jim Carrey, and I'm going to hear from the mask... the Cuban Pete number, and then I'm going to hear, and then I'm going to visualize that.
My body is a roadmap of pain!
And I'll be like, you ruined him for me.
You know what he's turning into?
You ruined Jim Carrey.
You know what he's turning into? Remember the In Living Color sketch where he played old Jimmy Stewart? That's what he's turning into. And on that note, I think we should go sign off.
What's our theme for next month, though?
Our theme for next month was suggested by Matt Lynch. It is the Michael Winner Feminist Trilogy, I believe.
It is?
Yes.
What's that?
He mentioned the films, and I have forgotten what they are. I'll have to look them up. But that's what we're doing.
Wait, hold it. We're going to find this out right now, because I have no idea what we're
Michael
talking
Winner,
about.
Michael Winner, not Winter, dude.
Winner?
Yes, as in the guy who directed
Death
Wish.
We are the champions. My friend, it's loading slowly, hold on. Here we go. Death Wish. Not the casting director of some other film.
Not the casting director of something else.
Oh, The Sentinel. I like The Sentinel.
Yeah, The Sentinel was one of them. I think
you don't like The Sentinel.
I've never seen The Sentinel.
Fuck off. How about that?
I think it was The Sentinel. I think it was Scream for Help. And
Wicked Lady?
It might have been The Wicked
Firepower?
Lady.
Firepower?
I honestly don't remember. Hold on a little.
Ew, The Mechanic.
The Mechanic isn't very good.
Oh, The Cool Mikado, something like that.
I don't remember what the third
something
one
like
is.
Like It Cool, Play It Cool. Cool, Cool. The Girl Getters, You Must Be Joking. I'll Never Forget What's His Name.
Yes, folks, we are going to watch every single one of the films that Simon has just made.
Throw me a bone here, fucko.
I told you I didn't remember, okay?
I'm trying to jog your memory.
Memory is not jogged.
Appointment with Death?
It's not Appointment with Death. Anyway, well...
Trilogy, The Sentinel.
Dude, we're recording. Let it go.
Michael Winner. Oh, there's too many ends in that. Yeah, we can't do this now.
Yeah, this has to be hashed out later.
It was entertaining, at least, to hear me Googling frantically.
Frantically Googling, yes.
It's like a David Fincher film, except none of the fun.
Yes. But anyway, yeah, so the next one will be our first full listener suggestion. As you recall, last month's theme was partially suggested by a loyal listener.
Who?
Matt Dunn had thrown out the idea of Attack of the Beast Creatures.
Oh, last month. I thought you were talking about... Okay.
Yes, last month. But this coming month will be the first time we've ever fully taken on a suggestion from a listener. So,
thanks!
Thank you, listener.
It's Matt Lynch, dude.
Thank you, Colonel Mortimer.
Anyway, that's all for us. We have to go torture ourselves some more. We are going to go watch The Darkest Hour and The Devil Inside in the same night because we hate ourselves.
If possible.
Yes. We're going to do it. It's going to happen. Trust me, it'll happen.
All right, just let it happen.
It'll happen.
Just open wide.
You just got to open up.
Oh, yeah.
Open yourself real wide.
Open right, your... Okay.
Let's get going.
Okay, bye-bye.